Listen to the podcast because we read it so you don't have to. That was humorous.
Appreciate the assumption. No. Oh, I've never got M&Ms.
This is angry tech guy. Stop it.
Throwing haymakers. Do you feel attacked? Greetings and welcome to another potentially useful From the Desk of the Director episode of the TCAP Sloop podcast. My name is Larry Burden, and joining Danielle and I on today's pod is the Muad'Dib of megabytes. It's Evan Obranovic. It's part three of our NetP series, so strap in as we uncover the gap between those with tech access and those without and explore how it shapes learning. We'll dive into impacts and share possible solutions to bridge this divide. Get ready for a thrill ride where tech equity and education collides with this week's TCAP Sloop moment of Zen. This might be the worst intro I have ever done.
Yeah, maybe.
It might. It's in the top 10 for sure. But the moment of Zen, my friends, is solid. We are greater than and greater for the sum of us. Heather McGee. Here we are. We're back again. The final episode of the NetP. We're going to take on the digital divide access. I'd said that wrong.
Digital access divide.
Digital access divide. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
And what I saw, and I think there might be some disagreements with what I saw, I thought we were ahead of the curve. And with that, I thought that we might be able to share some of the resources and ideas and some of the steps that we took to get closer to meeting some of the recommendations that we're going to go through, but also shed some light on some of the struggles that we've run into, some of the hurdles that we've faced. This is the front that you guys have been on for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
So where do we start?
I would like to introduce the digital access divide and talk about what it is first. The digital access divide is between those students and educators who have equitable, sustainable access to connectivity, devices, and digital content, and those who do not. This also includes accessibility and digital health, safety, and citizenship. Those are all key to closing that digital access divide.
Let's start with this, because I think this is something that they've touched on in every aspect of the NetP, which is giving yourself a target to shoot for. And for this one, it's the portrait of a learning environment. So we have the portrait of a graduate, a portrait of an educator, and a portrait of a learning environment to set expectations around habits and abilities, no matter what the space. And this one's focused on states and districts. So where are we at in the process of developing a portrait of a learning environment? It might have a different name, but I know that this is something that we do think about.
My view of it is internally, or I guess within the district, we're actually in the thick of a process of kind of developing what that environment looks like that we can control. The conversation has been, I guess, elevated about outside of our district walls with COVID, right? That was the biggest thing. How are we getting all of these families and students access so that they could learn the same, if not better, outside of our, like, how are we doing that remotely, right? And so what do they need? And so some of these things are pretty obvious. They need reliable, high-speed access to the internet. They need a device that's capable of kind of accomplishing all the things that we might be asking of them. And so inside our walls, though, we're currently in this, we call it a research and development process, right, to redesign the classrooms and make those so that they're functional, and that includes what the students are using. So their devices, I think we're pretty set right now. There's not a better answer. So Chromebooks have been our answer in terms of getting that easily and out to everyone. And then how those are going to interact with what kind of AV setup we have in the classroom that the teachers can then manipulate, the students can interact with. We certainly don't call it portrait of a learning environment, but we're talking tech-wise, and now we've kind of pushed the excitement to the district to be like, yeah, we're really looking at how we can make all these better district-wide. Building A is way different than building B is way different than building C in terms of even all, when you get down to the nuts and bolts. There were attempts to standardize it, but it just didn't happen because, you know, funding's always an issue. Can we do it all at once and all that? So that's one thing that, like I said, we're looking at internally. And then I think externally, it's still been the question. And we don't have a great answer because I think it involves a lot of money of just figuring out, okay, how are we making sure the families still, how are they going to get their homework done? How are they going to continue on learning if they don't outside of the school day or if they can't come in to the building? And we have a mixed match of solutions out there, hotspots, and pointing them to programs that give them cheaper broadband access through some of the vendors and stuff. So that's there, but there's not a, I guess, concerted like, oh, you do this, right? A, B, and C. We're looking at addressing it. I just don't think it's been very systematic.
I think the other part of that portrait of a learning environment is going to include discussions on accessibility. So how do we make sure that our content is accessible to every student and there, we aren't artificially putting in barriers to their learning? And then that digital health, safety, and citizenship, both in school and out. How do we work with the students? How do we work with the families? I think all of that needs to be addressed in that portrait of a learning environment to make sure that it's not lost and that it's not just about devices and that infrastructure piece.
Just this piece is huge. It's really just setting a target, I think, for the rest of the recommendations that we're talking about. And I think it's really easy to get frustrated for a number of reasons, be it money, be it time, which are always the big hurdles that the educational systems run into. If you have a large district with a lot of buildings, that's going to be difficult because you can't upgrade every facility at the same time. And with the pace of technology, there's always going to be some level of haves or have-nots. I think the important part is, do we have a target for what we're shooting for? And are we revisiting that target and not rebuilding the target every time? If the culture and our goal, our portrait is consistent, we at least have something that we can work from.
So within this whole report, like I said, there's a lot of great ideas. And like even to Danielle's point, right, like adding accessibility in there and having that conversation. But there's a real fear, I think, across the board, like there is no standardization. We're talking from national down to the state, right? Michigan's not being told to do the same as Ohio, as California, as they're given this flexibility and freedom. And then they drop the bombs, which are important. Hey, make sure that all the curriculum resources and tools you have, you know, have this accessibility function without like, this is what it looks like. We've vetted these certain ones and they're doing it right. Like, it's just kind of like, make it accessible. Okay, that's great. And then you pick your product up and you're like, ooh, this isn't it. And now am I going to totally thrash that and move to the next one? It's just difficult because we always want to give the choice and the freedom and you want to customize that. But at a certain point, that can become detrimental because then you have no control or standardization to go back to even what we're trying to do equipment wise of like, I know that this exists here or that everyone's going down this path using these certain tools because we know it's going to address the needs.
You're absolutely correct. We are not standardized. We don't have examples to work from to standardize. I'm looking at this and I'm seeing them say, we need some examples. We need people to try some things so we can find out what works. We were using the word pragmatic earlier. And I look at this very pragmatically and think we had an illusion that we're way farther down the road than we are in our integration of technology in education. And we're just not effectively and in a standardized way. I think this document is saying we got to back up and really look at a design process on how we're going to start to look at all the pieces. Give us examples, districts, on what you're doing so that then maybe we can have real conversations about what's working, what's not working, so that then we can get the ball rolling on some successful strategies that maybe on a state or federal level we can support. So with that, number two, establish and maintain a cabinet-level ed tech director to ensure the wise and effective spending of ed tech funds. Well, wise is questionable, but we do have a cabinet-level ed tech director, so that's good.
So is ed tech funds. It's questionable. It's an easy word to say, but yes. No, I look at that, and it's like, to the district's credit, like when they looked at bringing somebody in, even in my conversations and being like, hey, I'm not server fixer guy. Or, you know, I don't build networks or servers from the ground up. And they go, that's fine. That's not what we want. We're looking for someone who's been in the classroom as well and has an understanding and can make those connections. So that to me is valuable. And whether you can afford to say have a separate one, which might be great. I think the bigger you are, that makes more sense. Smaller, obviously, just not logical. So then you just need someone who's got those skill sets or lives in one or both of those worlds. So, and I should know, but I frankly have not had any interactions with a state level specific person in that realm, but I'm sure we have something to that effect.
So they're a team of two.
This might be pointing out where the sticking point is. You know, there's an area that's maybe needing to play catch up. Far be it from me to make recommendations for other districts, but it seems like if I was looking at an ed tech director, I would be looking at an educator for that role.
Yeah. Coming around to this point of if you're truly going to say you're integrating, then that person or people need to be integrated into some of those higher level conversations, because it just means they have a more direct connection. And so if you don't have those people at the table to be part of that conversation, you're, I guess, slowing the process down.
All right. Three, conduct regular needs assessments to ensure technology properly supports learning states, districts, building level administrators.
I think it's difficult because it involves a coordination effort between those groups, like we just said, or maybe all at the table with curriculum and the building level folks and teachers. And that's just not always easy to do. And it's just a hard coordination to then have those come and make sure you're getting all the right opinions, especially the bigger you are. And we're certainly not the biggest district, so I can't imagine on a larger scale. But there's a recognition of the value of that, and that we need to sometimes assess that. And there needs to be kind of bigger conversations on, as we're integrating, as we're adopting new curriculum and there's different tools involved, or do our tools existing meet the needs to kind of deliver that? Those happen, but I don't think it's always top of mind. It's just not as probably systematic and built in as you'd want for it to be like effective.
This is a hard one for, I think, any district that has multiple building level administrators. I don't think it's the administrator's fault. I think we run into systems issues that most districts would have. And what I was hoping that there were some ideas or examples within the document that looked at possible solutions, though I know maybe not easy to implement. There's so much in this document, it's hard to parse through all of it. This is where I struggled, to be honest.
That one even in particular, so when you talk about assessing, doesn't really have some large section or even some examples of, here's a district that created this assessment process. So for that one, in terms of how does it apply to anyone, it'd be interesting to hear from a lot of different places on how they would elevate that and what they consider this a needs assessment versus other places. I think those would all be different conversations, but I think it's a good conversation.
Many of these recommendations and some of the other sections have had tools associated with them. It is telling that this one does not.
But
as far as number three, specifically.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Oh, so I thought there's a lot of tools in here.
This one specifically.
Yep.
So I think that, you know, this is a good one to star as far as, okay, this is uncovering an area that, if this is important, needs a good bit of work.
Yeah, I think you move good on. I think you can actually blend it with four, a model process guidelines for device refresh policies based on local funding structures. That's the biggest asterisk at the end of there. A local funding structure will determine how this works. Going to conferences or having different sessions where you listen to how all these different districts are trying to do it or have to push off, or even in our case, like waiting for a next bond election, because there's not necessarily a hard and fast standard, even a statewide, on how all these schools are kind of getting enough dollars to do that. That's certainly a tricky one that I don't think has, there's not a set plan. Like 4 or 5 years is this standards set by an industry, right, to replace a device. But man, it's hard to tell certain places, I'd imagine, that you got to re-up all your devices in 4 years if they can find the dollar figure as those costs fluctuate.
I've loved the way our district handles this because of the way we set up our bond structures. And I think this is true for every district because funding for this is coming from a school's bond.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just probably how it's going to be done, at least in our state. The way our bonds are set up, there's consistent funding going to the device refresh. We can kind of count on it. Yes, it's part of our bond asks, but our bond asks are consistent and the technology is always part of the bond ask. So we know it's going to happen. So as far as a structure that is working, a model that is working, that's not bad.
It's a pretty good guideline.
Yeah.
Like, we're very fortunate in that, as long as bonds keep passing, which the community tends to support, which we are very thankful for, when you're talking hardware, because there are those restrictions on it, that's a great way to address it. At least, like we said, for our state And that's just always interesting because you hear vendors who you know are working with other places who might not have it, having their other ideas for how to, say, acquire the devices and different thoughts and plans and lease options and things that we are fortunate enough to kind of be like, we don't do that. This is how we plan because we just know, like we said, we have that steady, consistent money where we can truly have a refresh cycle schedule. You always have to be a little flexible, but that's a pretty big bonus for us. Again, it would be interesting to see for those who just don't even have maybe the ways and means for bonds, like what that might look like for them.
The other aspect of this would be, of course, the actual curriculum and making sure that we have funding and replacement cycles for that. That's a whole different ball game. So let's talk about bonds some more. And then Danielle will go to sleep. It'll be fine.
It's fine.
All right. Number five, leverage state purchasing power or regional buying consortia when purchasing EdTech hardware, software, and services. This kind of goes back to number 3, 4, and 5.
Mm-hmm. Thankfully, Michigan has a great system in place with that, with the REMC bid list, though, that our prices can be negotiated at a higher level there and shared throughout the state.
That's pretty much totally on the state.
Boom.
I mean, the districts need to take advantage of it, but we have that. So that's great.
Thank you, Ramsey.
Well, you know what, Daniel? What's number 6?
Develop learning technology plans in consultation with a broad group of stakeholders and according to established review cycles. So again, that's getting all of your stakeholders on board to be a part of that conversation, including students. I think students have a valuable perspective. We don't often include students in those teams.
Are there any examples in the NetP?
There are quite a few examples throughout here where they talk about bringing together those stakeholders and making sure to include student voice within those technology plans. I love that part.
Yeah, I mean, building those groups, I think it just becomes difficult with timing, making sure those people have the time that they can commit to that kind of, because it's a long process. That's the only downfall I see of that. It's always the best idea to have those larger groups and have those conversations. I think often what deters folks is it's just usually painfully slow. And, you know, by participating doesn't always mean you get everything that you want. You're just getting the voice into the room so that a larger collective decision can be made. And getting those people in is huge. And when we have those conversations, it's so helpful. Any chance you can, you'd probably have to tap the go-getters in the students because they're just always kind of usually more willing. They want to give that time. They're excited about that potential. Again, they understand maybe that process. I'm giving my voice just because I say I like A doesn't mean I'm going to get this all the time, but they're going to listen to me, right? You want to show that value too. So it'd be, again, interesting to kind of get involved with the other places, as Danielle said, that maybe have the examples. So what works and what doesn't for you? That's where the useful connections can come from this plan for sure. That broad group of stakeholders is always never a bad thing.
So 7 is a regard to broadband internet access to previously underconnected areas to ensure that students can access everywhere all the time learning. Evan did touch on that really well at the beginning of the podcast.
So 8, develop processes and structures that ensure the inclusion of accessibility as a component of procurement processes. States, districts, building level administrators, and I'm just going to clear out.
Yes. Let's talk about accessibility. Let's make sure that students can actually access the things that we are giving them. This plan gives some really, really good recommendations of things to think about. Like, accessibility isn't just speech-to-text software or specific web accessibility standards. It's a part of that, but it's also making sure that you have physical accessibility. So do you have students that need some kind of a specialized keyboard and you're getting them those materials? Visual accessibility, so things like high contrast settings, screen magnification software. A lot of that is built into our Chromebooks, but do the programs that we're going to purchase, do they work with the Chromebook accessibility features? That's an important part of it. Auditory accessibility, so how are we adding in transcripts for audio or video content, speech-to-text software, classroom amplification systems? I know that's a part of our refresh that we're talking about to help with that auditory accessibility. The cognitive accessibility features that are good for every student. So the text-to-speech, the voice recognition software, text highlighting tools, graphic organizers, all those things that just help kids better access the content. And then things like language accessibility. How are we helping our multilingual learners? Are we offering different versions of the digital content in their language? The ability to raise and lower readability of content, creating audio and video content that accommodates users with limited literacy skills. It's all those groups working together. Again, you know, your instructional technology group, your curriculum, your special ed, your information technology teams. It's getting all of their input on board to make sure that those teams aren't siloed so that we can give our kids the most accessible content and that make sure that's not a barrier for them.
That list is a good kind of review of those. I think a lot of people, you have those in your brain or you think about those items, but to kind of have them listed out, and one I think you touched on but didn't specifically say, number five was the digital accessibility. I highlighted that in the cognitive accessibility because, again, I think that's something you don't often separate out, but is a really good point to consider. So it's something you can kind of immediately pull from this is like taking a look at that list and then using it as part of a rubric in evaluating what else that you might be thinking of adopting.
And saying that that's not just the role of the special ed department, or that's not just the role of curriculum to make sure. That's kind of on all of us. That's on teachers as they're creating materials. That's on ed tech. That's on everybody to make sure that our students can access the materials that we offer in our classrooms.
One thing that's missing in that list is vendors. It's all well and good that we're looking for it, but if the vendors aren't including it or aren't valuing it, what are we going to do then?
Well, the vendors are producing what we're buying. So if we're not saying that's important to us, then they're not going to spend the extra money to make things accessible. So I think we need to have a louder voice that that is something that we value. And that is something that is a necessity before we purchase anything.
All right, nine. Plan for and incorporate skills and expectations across all grade levels and subject areas for digital health, safety, citizenship, and media literacy.
What? That's not important.
First time we've touched on this?
It's a new concept. I love seeing that in the plan. I think it is really, really important. And the plan does break it out into those three categories: digital health, digital safety, and citizenship. And then media literacy. And it talks about things like setting digital boundaries, having mindful technology use, having a responsible online behavior, keeping copyright and privacy and cybersecurity all in the forefront of what you do. And then they threw out a phrase too, which I thought was amazing, algorithmic literacy, which made me think back to that podcast that we had with Megan talking about how the algorithms are there and understanding what they are and how they work. I think that's an important piece of this as well. But what I love about the plan is that it doesn't just talk about students or your staff. It reaffirms what we've been doing with families. There's an idea in here, and they lean on the dual capacity building framework for family school partnerships. This is a guide that is designed for building just those family school partnerships more broadly, but it's really well suited for having this conversation about how do you build that digital health, digital safety, and digital citizenship capacity among your families, and how do you meet them where they are, and how do you bring in those families who may not have had such amazing experiences in school. It's crucial that the families are a part of that conversation and that they have that they have it as well.
I'm so happy you brought that up, because as we're going through this, the one thing that I'm not seeing in any of these recommendations is our community as far as its target. It's states, it's districts, building level administrators, and I get to some extent, you know, you control what you can, but then again, states are in here. So really, almost all these pieces oftentimes directly involve community engagement and responses. So maybe my question to the plan is, and maybe this is one of the things that, Evan, you are struggling with, is there's no feedback loop involving our users or our community. And if we don't have that, how are these going to get done?
They kind of touch on it in terms of the one line I keep kind of reading over in my head right now. As community organizations, schools are uniquely positioned to help bridge this gap in understanding and may need guidance in seeking to communicate about out-of-school activities and habits. So they're kind of pointing to the fact that, like, you hopefully have these connections with your communities and your families to help drive some of this. And that's right before going into the dual capacity building framework model that Danielle was just talking about. I think it's super important. I think it's something that we all recognize as a need to kind of bridge that gap and provide the resources, it's just really hard to do. Just a question of resources and time and capacity. You know, unfortunately, we live in a time where certain topics like this or even the conversations can be really divisive. And so you try and walk that balance as a school because you just want to include everyone. You just want to help everyone and not trigger any sort of blowback about what it may be perceived as what you're trying to do, as opposed to just, again, providing some resources, some tools, some guidance, good habits for your students to hopefully use in school, but obviously carry outside of the building, right? And then if we're also being tasked with or asked to help provide those resources, like, can we help them get access to reliable internet? And can we get them a device that can go home? This is a big part that comes with that, in my opinion. I think everyone would agree with that. So I don't think you're doing a good job bridging the access gap if you're not including this kind of element of digital citizenship, safety, that kind of knowledge.
And as an ed tech coach, one of the things that's on my list of things I want to do in this document, there's a good list of 10 questions. I guess it came from the U.S. Department of Ed, Office of Educational Technology, under the title of Has Your School Had Enough? 10 Questions Schools Can Ask to Build Better Digital Health and Safety. And they're just questions like, does your school or district have a clearly articulated vision for this digital health and safety of students? How are you collecting data and evidence? What measurable goals have you established? How are you including families? Even just to get your own brain dump on this and what you're systematically going to do. And the last one asks, like, what kind of ongoing funding sources can you leverage to support these efforts? I think that's a nice place to start for the people who are thinking through how to build these systems into their schools.
It almost sounds like when we go back up to one and develop a portrait of a learning environment, referencing those questions might be a decent place to start.
Sure could.
What else we got?
I just want to mention one part that I really like, and honestly, because I was going through the plan with a giant highlighter, I didn't get to until the end. There's a great appendix section, and it does give a nice one-pager that I've kind of been looking for. One-pager guide for state leaders on how to shrink these divides. One-page guide for district leaders. There's a one-page guide for school leaders, and there's one for educators. And I like that this feels like actually things that you could do. Like, as a school leader, do you have a rubric to support your tools to make sure that they meet UDL? Do you solicit feedback from diverse stakeholders to collaborate on decision-making for technology purchases, learning space design, and curriculum planning? Those are things that are doable. Or as an educator, like, are all the students I serve having active, creative, critically thoughtful experiences supporting by technology? Does every student in my classroom have access to the learning experiences I design? They're simple questions that you can kind of use as a starting point to evaluate your own practice and to evaluate what's happening in your classrooms.
Super easy to review and hopefully get your mindset into the right place to do that. I love the ideas. I love the concepts. I just really want to all of a sudden get the best idea of, like, how to provide the right resource and everything for all these districts, all these states to hopefully, like, have the time and the wherewithal to dig into it and use those kinds of things, ask those questions, and then come up with some actionable items for it. And so it'd be nice to see if they put together some kind of larger, talking about stakeholder groups, like if the state decided to start bringing together the districts to look at the plan, like, I'm sure they're going to do that in some way, but just a really large effort so that there becomes some standardization. That would be, I think, really impactful.
I think we have a unique opportunity right now because post-COVID, districts were purchasing all this technology and making sure that students had access. And we're starting to talk about making sure that things are accessible and making sure that kids have access to digital health curriculum, digital safety curriculum. Like, we're at a good point to hopefully actually make some movement on these things right now. Unique opportunity.
It'd be interesting to go back to the 2017 plan and see some of the similarities and differences, because I have a feeling some of these same concepts are there.
So I think this kind of, like, gives you the whole map, but you're like, so which, am I going up north? Am I going south? Should we do it as a state? Am I just worrying about myself as a district and how to handle it? And, you know, it has that division, but I think a lot of these concepts span between all those entities, between a state and a district, in terms of how you would truly get it done and do it well. And so that, to me, is kind of those next step questions.
Any last words on this piece or the NetP as a whole?
I'm excited. I'm excited to see all the things that I am passionate and that I care about all combined in a guiding document for schools and districts.
Can't wait for 2031.
All right. Hey, do we have a tech tool of the week?
Tech tool of the week. I would like to elevate the Center on Inclusive Technology and Education Systems. It is part of that umbrella CAST organization that we talked about a couple weeks ago, maybe last week. But
Last 2 weeks.
I know, because I love what they're doing. This specific section aims to empower your school districts to build and maintain those tech systems to make sure you're including every student, including those with disabilities and those who require assistive tech and accessible materials. What I love about this is they offer a framework to help you get this stuff going, step-by-step process for identifying and removing barriers. They even offer a great district example section, and you can read case studies about how districts are implementing, for example, technology plans grounded in that Universal Design for Learning framework, or how they're helping struggling students who don't have IEPs or 504s. There's some really nice case studies on here as well in the district example section. So it is CITES.cast.org.
Awesome. Hey, Evan, where can they find you online?
Oh, I'm just everywhere. Still rocking my LinkedIn, my professional networking tool. It's just my name. Or you can find me on X, formerly known as Twitter.
Kind of hurt a little bit, didn't
it? My favorite tagline. I just like saying the whole thing. I'll never not say formerly known as Twitter. Oh, and I have dabbled into Blue Sky, which is the former Twitter founder's newest attempt at moving there. It's at least seemingly a little less
yucky.
Intense, hateful.
Toxic word.
Toxic, there you go. So, but it's building up. I think
it's social media, give it time.
There's some potential. Yeah. It's only going to take a little while. But yes, all those and all just my name, find me there.
All right. That was awful. All right, Danielle, how about you?
At Brostrom DA on social.
All right. You can find TCAP Sloop on LinkedIn, Facebook, The Artist, formerly known as Twitter, and Instagram. Rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Cast, Podbean, CastBox, Overcast, Lord, or wherever else you get your ear candy. Thanks for listening and inspiring.
That's amazing. Yes, 100%.